You're listening to the OneOfUs.net podcast network.
Hey, we're back. Our look at Twin Peaks episodes 12 and dun 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 13. Just because the number 13.
Oh, naturally.
Yeah. I was actually expecting something very 13 specific, but David's like, that's too on the nose. Everybody's expecting me to have a black cat involved in the plot or something.
Arm wrestling, okay? That's all I need to know.
Arm wrestling. Yeah. Indeed. Brought me back to summer camp. But as usual, we do this by going through the first episode first, which is always somewhat difficult when some of the things that we really want to talk about happen in the second one.
Yeah.
First off, I'm Chris.
I'm Ian.
I'm Betty.
I'm Scott.
And we are going to talk about this shit. I'll just start by saying episode 12 is my least favorite episode of the entire show so far. And the only episode I would honestly say at the end, I was like, well, I didn't enjoy watching that. Which is a weird thing to have to admit to myself. Huh. But there were some cool parts to it, no question, and some important stuff that happened. Let's start with the Wikipedia synopsis of the episode, which is always awkwardly missing stuff, but kind of funny to read. Mm-mm. Would someone else want to read this one? I read it every week.
Sure.
Do it. Can you see it okay, or should I make it bigger? Okay.
All right. It's missing the thing with Harry Dean Stanton telling the guy to give his blood.
We'll get to it.
Which is my favorite part of the show.
Yeah.
Gordon Albert recruit Tammy and deputize Diane, let's rock, to the Blue Rose Task Force. Sarah Palmer has an unsettling experience in a grocery store, which leads Deputy Chief Hawk to check on her at her house. Albert interrupts Gordon and his French lady friend to show him a text message Diane received asking about Las Vegas. Cooper and Sonny Jim play catch. Audrey Horne demands that her husband Charlie help her find Billy, her missing lover. He reluctantly phones Tina and is astonished by what he tells him, but does not tell Audrey what Tina said. Chantel and Hutch assassinate Warden Murphy. Frank Truman visits Ben Horne to tell him his grandson Richard killed the boy in the hit and run, and then attempted to kill the only witness, Miriam. Ben gives Frank the key to room 315 as a memento for Harry and agrees to pay Miriam's medical costs. Diane finds that the coordinates on Ruth Davenport's arm point to Twin Peaks.
Right on. Thank you, sir. Thank you, Scott. All right, so getting into depth here, first off, yay, the origin of the Blue Rose Task Force. And letting Albert be the one to tell it was also kind of a pleasure.
Yeah.
I mean, I think we've said it before, but Cole and Albert are basically the Cooper and Truman of this new season.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, they're definitely giving them those roles in a weird sort of way. And Albert, who was, like, you know, intentionally unlikable originally, is so goddamn likable now. He's almost the audience avatar of, like, quit the bullshit, David. What are you trying to say?
The scene with the French lady getting dressed, Albert's like, seriously?
It's just like he's giving him the daggers for eyes, that whole sequence. Of course, there's a lot of speculation, which came a little later, the scene where the French girl is like lazing all over him, is that she's actually not who Cole is flat out representing her as being, but is somebody like in Fire Walk With Me, the chick who was doing the symbolic Blue Rose messaging. Yeah. And you're like, and her whole story is a little weird, like right from the get-go. You're like, what is happening right now? I mean, it's hard to picture, like, Cole as a lech, and they play him so, like, where she's putting on her lipstick, he's like mirroring her put on her lipstick, which, to be fair, David Lynch decidedly has a fetish for in real life, but nonetheless, thought that was very strange, him explaining that the French woman was visiting a friend of her mother's whose daughter has gone missing, and then, of course, possibly the lowest point of this entire series, him making a turnip joke. Only saved by Cole, by Albert's fuck you face.
That was a great show. I love that show.
I'm not sure it was. But, I presume that if Chester Desmond knew about this method of communication in Fire Walk With Me, it's possible that there is something else that even Albert isn't in on. Or maybe he is, and he wasn't giving him a fuck you stare. He was trying to decipher what the fuck it meant.
Yeah, maybe.
I don't know.
It's harder to, they look the same.
Yeah.
It's the same look.
Yeah, it is the same look.
I feel like watching this episode, it was the first time this season, I got a little worried that this is all some big practical joke we're watching. But between that scene and then later on we get to Audrey, I'm like, okay, man, we're six episodes away from the end. Why are you pulling this now? Like,
yeah, what's happening?
What are you doing? don't do this.
Yeah, at the end, the whole cast come out and sing a rousing version of, I don't know what, something.
We'll meet again.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, no.
One thing here that I don't know if it was like a mistake they made or what, but I noticed it right off the bat was when they were telling the Blue Rose Task Force history, said the first member was Philip Jeffries, who hired Dale Cooper, Chet Desmond, and Albert.
Yeah.
But in Fire Walk With Me, when the sort of vision of Jeffries shows up, he's never seen Dale Cooper before. Which, I don't know, maybe that's
time looping.
Or he kind
of has, because he says, you don't know who that is, but Cooper and Cole introduces him as, this is the long-lost Philip Jeffries, as if he never met him and only heard about him through stories.
Right.
So, he'd already been recruited to Blue Rose at that point, so what the fuck?
Could he have recruited him just over the phone and never met him or seen his face?
Possible?
Like, he was a shadow agent? Like,
it seems like an application process there'd be several interviews for.
Well, the theory I've always had since I first saw Fire Walk With Me, for that line specifically, the who do you think that is there, I always thought maybe because, you know, Jeffries had been in the lodge for so long that maybe he saw the doppelganger Cooper before he saw actual Cooper.
It could be. Yeah, and the lodge time, as we know, is wibbly-wobbly, timey-wimey, as it were. Also, that in that whole sequence when they're, what's her name? God damn it, Tammy? When they're recruiting Tammy, and then they recruit Diane with all of us knowing this is a sort of wink-wink, where keep your enemies close, you know? I read some stuff that sold me on this immediately, because I thought there was something weird, that whole sequence took place before episode, I believe it was 11, when they go to the place that where the coordinates were, and Hastings' head gets blown off. And I was like, yeah, because that is weird. Why is Diane even there, and why is Tammy there, who has not been indoctrinated into the deeper secrets, as far as we knew at that point? And kind of putting an exclamation point on that for me was, the last time we see Diane in this episode, she has changed into a dress that is the dress she was wearing at Hastings' scene. Right. And also, that sort of, you think she would have transferred those, like, coordinates almost immediately?
Yeah.
And we see her, it's not till then, she's drunk at the bar, looks like she's just gotten out of something that was bad, and has is still trying to remember the coordinates she saw a full episode ago.
Yeah.
So I'm thinking we're seeing a bit of a stuff out of time.
That's something between this episode and the next one, is the passage of time in this show.
It's wrong.
Between all the different storylines is kind of wonky, because, not to jump ahead, but there's a bit in episode 13 when Bobby mentions, like, oh yeah, we found a clue from my dad earlier today. I'm like, that's like seven episodes ago. What are you talking about?
And jumping ahead, there were no gunshots in the window. No one, he seemed pretty calm for a guy who just almost got assassinated.
Although part of me wonders if, to a certain extent, if that's just them kind of fudging with the timeline and just, you know, editing scenes that were shot kind of in a different order together. But I also wonder if, to a certain extent, it might be at least somewhat intentional with some of the time loop stuff we kind of see in the next episode.
Yeah, it could be. There's a lot of weird little time is wonky things going on right now. As well, anybody else think it's weird that the inside of the hotel that for some reason they haven't left yet in, where is it, Mayfair, the Mayfair in Buckhorn, North Carolina, it looks like the entrance to the, it looks like the Black Lodge in that one wall. It's got the whole red curtain and everything. We're like, well, that's an odd decision. Adding to the whole, maybe all these people are kind of stuck in some sort of dreamlike offshoot of, like, the lodge.
Yeah.
Which, also, long discussion. I didn't know how to summarize, but I saw people asking the question. So, wait, what's the Black Lodge and what's the White Lodge? And is the place we see just a waiting room between them?
Yeah.
Or there's a lot of confusion about where we're actually seeing
it. Like, have we actually
and if everyone in the Black Lodge is bad, how come Mike, who we always see in what we think is the Black Lodge, is always there to help?
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, he's in the neutral zone.
Yeah, I assume that's just...
room?
And that ring is supposed to protect people, and maybe, but jumping ahead, but...
Not always.
I mean, we're not sure the actual what that meant when they originally said, but yeah, we'll get to the ring in episode 13 where that becomes very relevant. Jerry running out into the woods. Once again, our little weekly look at Jerry being stoned out in the mountains. And I saw no one else reference this, but it looked to me like his hands were bloody.
Were they?
It's what it looked like to me when I was watching it.
Huh.
But I heard no one else reference it, so maybe I was just tired.
And I think that's a really good indication of time loop, because everything he says points to, you know, Ben saying things before. That's what you said last time. He seems to very much be stuck in some sort of time loop.
And maybe he's one of the few people who's actually aware,
right?
Like becoming really aware that something's not right. This shouldn't be happening this way.
He's like the character in Cabin in the Woods. He's so stoned that he's actually aware of everything that's going on around him.
Yeah, and he, if anyone, would have the extendable bong. So you can use it as a weapon. We finally actually get some relevant stuff with Sarah Palmer, who we've been kind of like seeing flashes of, but nothing that really seemed pertinent. And her going into the grocery store and like getting freaked out by turkey jerky, which to be fair, we've all done. Gone, what? Turkey jerky? That doesn't seem right. Her freaking out. I've read EW always has a good recap. I read 4 or 5 to put these together, but they were suggesting it was that because there was something there that wasn't there before, mm-hmm. made her sort of go like it was a trigger for all the times that she's just been kind of not really had no idea what was going on, mm-hmm. stuck in this between worlds thing. And it's also the first time since Fire Walk With Me we've heard that ambient music that they play, and I was like, oh my god, it's that theme.
Yeah.
So I'm glad I found out specifically it played during the autopsy of Teresa Banks, crescendoing when Agent Stanley found the letter under her fingernails. It appeared when Jeffries appeared in the FBI HQ in Philly, and when we see the meeting of the Black Lodge people in the room above the convenience store, all in Fire Walk With Me. Like, it was never in the theme they used in the original series. Yeah. But it's the first time we've heard it since then, which has to be relevant as she's sitting there having a sort of otherworldly freak out in this grocery store.
Yeah. And especially as this episode progresses, like, I'm fairly confident that that little girl we saw back in episode 8 in the 50s.
Is Laura Palmer.
That's a young Sarah Palmer. Because just some of the things she said, and just sort of like, I don't know, just the way that the scenes kind of play out, you know, it seems like it's too much of a coincidence, you know what I mean? Like, it just, it would fit, you know? Mm-hmm. And again, with there only being, you know, 5 episodes left.
I know she's always been kind of a, I don't know, psychic when it comes to Twin Peaksy type stuff, sensitive.
Yeah.
You know, and maybe that has something to do with what, if that was her, that experience she had then, maybe it was a protection experience.
Mm. I mean, remember the last episode of the show, she's been Major Briggs,
That's right.
With Cooper in the Black Lodge. And what was that about? That's never been totally explained.
That's true.
Is she Wendy Merle?
Well, that's the thing is in that last episode, she was basically being like a cipher for Wendy Merle from the lodge, taunting Major Briggs.
She's a channel,
and it makes you wonder if she's that same spirit. She brought is there some sort of like connected tissue going on, where maybe like when Hawk comes to the door or when she has her freak out, she's channeling some entity from the other side that's trying, maybe, you know, whether it be Mother or Bob. Be.
She's good or neutral.
Right.
But like you said, she channels. Like, she can't control it, and it takes over, kind of like if that frog entity entered her, it's like she's an empty vessel. She wasn't evil. But she is an open channel for that.
Her house seems to be a nexus for energies as well.
That's shout-out ceiling fan, though.
Yeah. I mean, come on. That whole shot of the ceiling fan that was like brought you right back to the original series and all the times they focused on that ceiling fan in the hallway leading up to Lara's room.
Yeah.
You're like, okay. But just for being able to repeat it for people listening, the actual thing she says when she's freaking out the turkey jerky, were you here when they first came? And men are coming. I'm trying to tell you that you have to watch out. Things can happen. They can happen to me. Something happened to me. So there's that. And you mentioned, of course, Hawk coming to check if she's okay. Yeah. One of several times in this episode that were about people just being a good dude. You know, Hawk, of course, being the guy who's like definitely an emblem for all that is like good. You know, he is a real hero. As is Carl, who we see in a scene apropos of nothing except to remind you, Carl is fucking awesome.
Yeah. He's a good guy.
Just helping out the neighbor, going, I don't want you spice, you know, doing this shit, and people aren't paying you for you helping out around here. I'm gonna help you. It's pretty cool. But going back to Hawk there, what the fuck were those noises coming from her house?
That sounded someone like in the kitchen scratching.
Yeah.
It made me think she abducted the delivery boy, you know?
Or maybe he's just putting the stuff on the table and he's fine. It just sounded ominous.
Why would
she
not want to tell him?
Yeah.
Oh, I think it might go back to that whole bit in, what was it, episode 11 or 12 when Gordon has that whole vision of that portal up in the sky. And he sees all those woodsmen standing on that staircase. Mm-hmm. And that staircase is a very Laura Palmer's house.
It could be the same one. Yeah, it's just such a flash, and it's in negative, kind of. So it's like hard to say for sure the way it's lit if it was the same one. But it could be.
And that's the thing. Is the first time I saw it, I thought, well, maybe you know, Evil Cooper is already in Twin Peaks and we don't know it yet. And he's in the house. But obviously that's not the case. And so I'm wondering if maybe it's the woodsmen, or there's something some force is in that house still, or something's going on.
It could very well be
activating, and a portal's opening.
We get to see Miriam still alive, but doing good in the hospital. But I didn't even notice this. I saw someone read it. I went back and checked it out. Next to her on the table is a bouquet of blue roses.
Nice catch. Oh,
yeah. That can't be accidental, right?
No, because Richard's probably a. And the whole the evil spawn, he has to be.
He almost certainly.
Yeah.
Diane gets another text asking just Las Vegas, with her responding, they haven't asked yet, with the guys becoming aware. Well, what the fuck does that mean? Which brings another thing where I'm thinking this is out of order, because otherwise they would have fucking left to go to Las Vegas by now.
Yeah. Well, yeah, and that's the thing that, it seems more and more with Duncan Todd that, Evil Cooper's also essentially running this whole crime ring that spans the entire country, but has, a big sect of it.
What are you talking about? He's got his, penthouse in Nicaragua.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
But he's got his little, crime franchise set up in Las Vegas that Duncan Todd's, running, so. Yeah. And, again, if it's all out of order, maybe, Chantal and Tim Roth already went down there and something happened and he's trying to figure out, okay, nobody's getting back to me. What's happening?
It could be, or very well be that. Man, it's so hard to find good help these days.
When do you get Wendy's?
Yeah, exactly. Oh, my God. I can't believe that.
Frank Turman, we see him coming to tell Ben Horn about his grandson Richard being a piece of shit. And Ben is, embarrassed, startled, but not really that surprised either. That kid is no good, really.
He's never been right.
But mentioning specifically that he never had a father, so, adding to the whole maybe he was the child of rape there.
Yeah.
But that whole weird moment where Ben suddenly goes on this reverie about a bike his dad bought for him.
But it makes sense because it's like, oh, yes, because my father was there for me. Yet Ben, for the most part, was a piece of shit. He ran a brothel. He was a criminal. Yeah. He's not a good...
Until the second season where he decides, has a revelation that he's a bad guy and he needs to fix his life, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah, it reminded me of the Citizen Kane Rosebud.
Mm-hmm.
Reminiscent of that, his happiest memories was something that wasn't drugs and planning murder and prostitution and stuff. He was like, oh, yeah, life was simple once. I loved that bike.
Really? Because all my best memories involve drugs and planning murder and prostitution. Really, just very different people, apparently.
The good old days.
And yes, we see Hutch and Chantel finally assassinate the warden. Another thing with a kid being traumatized by something horrible happening in front of them. And then they go get Wendy's and what is definitely the most Tarantino moment we've seen in this whole show.
Yeah.
Not the least of which, because two Tarantino regulars in it. Dougie literally in this for 10 seconds, more like, so you're just reminding us that... But then after you see the next episode, I feel like this is there for the specific purpose of noting these are out of order.
Yeah.
Really?
That clearly takes another point.
There's no other reason to have that scene except until you get to episode 12 and going, wait,
when did that happen?
This isn't in order.
Because Dougie, last time I saw Dougie, he was with the Mitchum brothers, and then all of a sudden they're conga lining in episode 13.
Yeah. Well, they say he's been missing for 2 days, so when the fuck would he have been home playing catch with the kid, if that was the case?
That was one of those Polaroid Hallmark moments before the Mitchum brothers, I think.
By this point, we hadn't seen Mr. C for 3 straight weeks, and it was getting a little frustrating. What's going on with Dark Eyes? Old Dark Eyes. But we'll talk about him a lot in the next episode. Not next episode, but when we get to episode 13. Another endless Dr. Jacoby rant. I'm really kind of bored to tears with Dr. Jacoby. It's always the same shit.
That's the thing, between the Blue Rose scene earlier, and then we get to the Dougie thing, and then this scene, I'm going what the hell's going on? We've already seen this scene basically twice already.
We're time
right.
Which I think is deliberate. I think it was word for word the same thing.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
And then showed the ad and the shovel, and I couldn't give a crap about the shovels anymore.
Yeah, and having...
So do you think that Nadine was re-watching this obsessively? Because Nadine, she's wonderful, but she's obsessive with the...
A little bit.
The silent runners, and I'm thinking maybe she's obsessing on Dr. Amp and... This is becoming instead of maybe, hey, they'd make a great couple, it's she's stalking him or, obsessively watching his program.
It's hard to say. All the stuff with her, which up until just recently has just been her watching his show and going, this is great. And then with him, I mean, the only other thing we've seen him do other than do his show is paint shovels for his show. So it's all right, what does all this have to do with anything? And yes, it might be something else that has to do with that. Interesting point somebody made, that the last thing he says before we switch to the first time we see Audrey Horne in this whole show is that sentencing all treacherous hypocrites to the frozen lake in the ninth circle of hell. when then it immediately switches to, hey, it's Audrey Horne. And everyone goes, yay, Audrey. And then she is upset a lot.
And they go, what the fuck, Audrey?
All right, so we will, because there's no way to discuss this sequence without discussing this sequence and the one in episode 13. So we're just, you know, I mean, there's no way you can, because otherwise you'll just go, wow, she was irritating here. And then episode 13, you're like, oh, okay, now it's starting to make sense. What's going on? As we see her talking to her oddly, her like, never in a billion years would you have pictured she would have married actor, dwarf actor Clark Middleton as her husband, but they say that's her husband, although he acts more like her therapist. Yeah. And her just screaming at him because somebody named Billy, who there's a billion theories about who they might be, but nothing written in stone, is missing. This phone call that he makes to Tina, that you get the feeling that maybe he had an affair with her, and she flat out says she was having an affair with Billy. I don't know. They mentioned not only those two names, but also Paul and Chuck, two other characters that don't match up with anybody else we've met.
Yeah, don't want to call
One
Paul.
One of them is the guy who is the person who Andy was going to meet with.
Maybe.
Possibly.
Which name?
That's the theory.
Chuck. Yeah, and, like, and then there's someone's like, at the end of the episode, once when yelled and ran into the double R and said, where's Billy? And then ran out.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah.
Maybe.
But it may not even be the same. It may be a red herring to distract you from
There would never
else.
Be a red herring on this show.
Also, there seems to be all these weird rules around their marriage. Like, he keeps saying there's very specific agreements.
A contract. That's a very weird way of describing
it. Because he was really tired.
Yeah, really tired.
He's really sleepy. He's very sleepy. And I was like, oh, no, sleepy dwarf. I'm sorry. But, I was like, oh, no. The reference is a little weird.
And I know that conversation annoyed a lot of people, but the one-sided conversation he had with Tina I thought was the funniest thing I've ever seen. I, like, laughed for a good 20 minutes. Because I'm like, oh, man, this is awful. You're doing all the wrong deliberately. So I'm sure, like, I can't believe you said that. That is shocking to hear. Yeah, you're not going to tell them what you said. Nope.
Yeah. That stare. It was like a 1,000-yard stare, just staring. Like, what he heard just blew his mind, and he just... glitched and permanently out.
And like a lot of people, even after this first episode, were saying this feels like a television show inside a television show or something.
It
like
felt
it felt
very
not real.
What
like
was
something
the show
is
they watched in the original show.
Invitation to Love.
Yeah. That's right.
And Audrey was very dramatic to begin with. But
she was dramatic in a sort of like teen girl detective sort
this
of way.
This is like angry middle aged lady sort of way.
Yeah, I was thinking that she might go and be. Like Tammy Preston, like she wanted to be an FBI agent. There was a Nancy Drew, like she wanted to be a go-getter.
And if she hadn't ended up in a coma, which we presume is exactly where I presume is exactly where she still is, that none of this is actually real, that her consciousness is maybe sort of in a coma, sort of in some offshoot of the lodge, affected by the Twin Peaks energies, that none of this is really happening. And episode 13 seems to pretty much put tack that to the board and say, yeah, that's pretty much it, with Audrey saying, I feel like I'm somewhere else, like I'm somebody else. Have you ever felt that? I'm not sure who I am, but I'm not me. And and continuing on with that, like Charlie saying, this is existentialism 101. And they're like going, yes, we know, we're watching Twin Peaks. And he threatens to end her story, which is like, I can't think of any other way that would mean anything except like, on some level, Audrey is aware this isn't real. And the idea of it being a story says maybe she's living out her version of this soap opera over the years and inside her own head.
Yeah.
Another weird mention I did not catch was, well, she goes, is this a story? The little girl lives down the lane? I don't know what that was supposed to mean. But she says, it's like Ghostwood here. Okay, so Ghostwood is the forest around Twin Peaks, but it is also the name of a project that her father, Ben, was starting up that when she got, you know, exploded in the bank in season two, she was out protesting the Ghostwood project, specifically.
Didn't they show where her brother Johnny and her mom... Did they have a house in the Ghostwood Projects? Was that a new house?
I don't think they mentioned it by name, but it looked like a very new housing development. And I was waiting in that episode. I was waiting for them to make some sort of mention of that being the finished Ghostwood Estates, but they never did.
Okay, because that's what I was thinking. Like,
it could be.
Okay, maybe.
Yeah. I mean, a lot of time has passed, but in her head, who knows?
Still the thing. Yeah,
and that would also be the whole like she wants to go to the Roadhouse, but she just stops herself from going, and it's like, well, maybe. Maybe you literally can't leave this room.
Well, and also it would all
being stopped by Charlie.
That would also kind of jive with the fact that we've had all these scenes with everybody else in the Horn family, and Audrey's never been mentioned once. But if she's apparently living close to Twin Peaks in this,
especially
whatever this is,
when they're investigating what happened to Richard, if that is her son, which we presume that it is, you'd think they would go, well, we should go talk to Audrey, unless she was absolutely in no way, shape, or form available to communicate.
And that's the thing. The only mention we've gotten of Audrey Horn from this was way back in episode like 7 or 8 when he's talking to Doc Hayward.
Mm-hmm.
And the only thing he mentions about her was, you know, when Cooper visited her in the ICU when she was in a coma.
Right.
So is it possible that she was in a coma, got pregnant, had Richard Horn, stayed in the coma, and faded off and died? And this is like some kind of delay where her mind or consciousness is still, the consciousness is still dreaming. Like she's passed into the
other she could be dead, or she could just be still in a coma.
Yeah.
You know, she might have never come out of it.
Or everyone's dead.
Or everyone is dead.
See, I'm waiting to
everyone's in the Black Lodge is what's happening.
I wouldn't be shocked.
The Black Lodge spilled out in the real world and everyone's in the Black Lodge now and we're all screwed.
All this makes me think.
There's
an image
I
posted on my Facebook I found somewhere recently. It made me laugh out loud and got reposted 18 times because everyone was like, yup, with this picture of a guy in a suit but with a lizard head. He's like, hey, sorry about all the weirdness. We were just testing out a program. We'll revert you back to your original reality from 3 years ago now.
The collider, people are saying a different timeline was created, hence we've...
It feels like we're in the darkest timeline right now.
There's something weird afoot.
We talked before about Diane. The last scene in here, what I didn't mention is that her remembering the coordinates and them for the first time seeing these new coordinates, the ones on Ruth's arm, they lead to Twin Peaks. And as we've said, everything seems like it's all coming back to Twin Peaks.
Yeah.
Ian is vibrating.
I'm very happy about that.
And then another what the fuck moment ending in the roadhouse where all of a sudden, here's some new people drinking Heineken.
Fuck that shit!
Thank you.
Yeah.
The Pabst Blue Ribbon! we're like, wait a minute, what? There's like these girls, and they say a friend named Angela who likes a dude named Clark who was seen kissing a girl named Mary is the story they're discussing. None of these characters are anybody we have any reference to or anything.
Yeah.
And then another character we have no reference to named Trick shows up who tells a story about being run off the road and a farmer pulling him out of the ditch and that he's out of house arrest.
Right.
And all of this, near as I can tell, not connected to anything that we've seen at all.
And that was like the final nail in the coffin for me on this episode where I was going like, are we watching a practical joke? Like, is this all just going to go nowhere?
Yeah. At this point, I was just irritated.
Yeah, exactly. I was like, okay, I get it. I get like, that's kind of the joke because you're just taking like a really long time to get to these things. But come on, man. Like, we're at episode 12. You got to fucking speed it up.
Yeah, there's only so many left, and the fact that you're still like filling in, putting in this filler makes me go. But then again, he very well may prove to just go, this was very important,
as he often does. When we get to episode 13, a lot of those worries I had were then like immediately alleviated.
Mm-hmm.
Episode 12 was actually all the deleted scenes that they just kind of put together.
It kind of felt that way, honestly. It really did. Yeah.
15 pieces, episode 12.
Anybody else want to read the synopsis of the next one of episode 13? Hold on, let me scroll to it here. Well, somebody else want to do it?
Yeah, I don't really want to do this all the time. Yeah.
Anybody else? Anybody?
I can't.
No? Betty?
I can't see very well.
All right, go ahead, Scott.
At Lucky 7 Insurance, the Mitchum brothers give Bushnell gifts. Duncan Todd orders Tony to kill Dougie. Cooper's doppelganger kills the gang boss. Ray tells him Philip Jeffries ordered him dead. And then a prison guard gave him a ring. After telling Ray to put the ring on his finger and getting the coordinates from him, he shoots him. It turns out Richard Horn is in the building, too. The owl ring and Ray's spirit turn up in the red room, where Mike's hand picks up the ring. The Fusco brothers get the results from Dougie's fingerprints, but refuse to believe it. Tony asks the corrupt policeman for a poison that will kill Cooper. Hutch and Chantel are driving on the road. Tony poisons Cooper's coffee, but ultimately confesses his collusion with Todd to Bushnell. Big Ed and Bobby have dinner together at the Double R, where we learn that Norma has turned her business into a chain. Nadine and Jacoby meet for the first time in 7 years. Sarah Palmer watches a loop of a boxing match at home. Audrey tells Charlie she doesn't know who she is and she can't leave the house. A woman at the roadhouse cries while James performs a song, Just You and I.
That was awkward. That was very awkward.
I mean, that's exactly what happened, but what?
I know. No, no. I mean, just that's the. I was just thinking of James at the end. Oh. I was like, oh, no. I think I said it out loud. Oh, no.
I think everyone said, oh, no, all at the same time. Like, oh, God, no.
All right. So let's get into this one. First off, Tom Sizemore getting to have a lot of fun acting in this episode, I suspect. Freaking out, climbing under the desk after we watch one of the funniest moments we've seen so far in the show with Coop and the Mitchum brothers and the out-of-it girls dancing the conga into the insurance office. Just laugh out loud funny, that whole sequence. And continuing on, the sort of like, man, I love the Mitchum brothers now. Yeah. I know they're murderers and criminals, but...
But they're fun, though.
Really like them, and they're like, we bought everybody a car! Just bizarre. I mean, they are so happy. And also, you just love to see Duncan Todd getting mad.
Right?
Oh,
that was
nice.
You're like, ah, fuck you, Duncan Todd. Whatever you're doing, it ain't good.
Yeah.
By the way, when he goes to get help from the cop in the station, that's John Savage, who we haven't seen do, like, he kind of moved into, like, supporting roles on television, but back in the 70s, he was kind of big. He was a major role in The Deer Hunter, The Onion Fields, Hair, Salvador, and more. It was kind of like, oh, wait, I knew I recognized that guy from somewhere.
He used to make Hair Turn Hair. Cool. That's right.
Huh? Yeah. Exactly. And also, somebody pointed out to me, poisoning coffee has to be the literal worst thing you could do in the world of Twin Peaks, right?
Oh, yeah.
Because that's coffee is the best thing. And they're like, poisoning it, that's the ultimate insult to do that. but that whole thing with, like, he's the guy's right. The cop is like, man, you're weak and you're worthless. Yeah. I'm like, I totally agree with them. After you're like, look, you can't even carry through on this because Dougie gave you what you thought was a shoulder massage and you were like... lost in guilt.
I think it was more like Dougie / Cooper's energy, White Lodge. Like, he just touched him and he just felt all this guilt because it's kind of, he's got Mr. Jackpots. He's got this energy that makes you feel guilty because he's so goddamn good.
Or that's just protecting him on some level like that.
Yeah.
He has an angelic aura, for sure.
Because he's charmed. He's Mr. Jackpot.
It's interesting that both he and Mr. C are incredibly good at getting what they want done, but in such a different way.
Yeah.
Doug in kind of a Mr. Magoo kind of way, or Forrest Gump.
Yeah. Very true. And Dougie's got the sweet car. Janie, he is definitely going to be having sex with him again sometime soon.
But yeah, and the pie saved him this time.
The pie did save him.
And he had coffee and pie.
Yeah, pie. Wow, the pie keeps saving him.
Yeah, and even like, even though he's still in Dougie mode, I noticed it more at the beginning when they were in the conga line and all that. His, like, Dougie act seems to be just a little more relaxed. Like, it's like... It still seems like it's three quarters Dougie, but like maybe a quarter Cooper.
Yeah.
Like he seems a little less sad, a little more like,
a little bit.
He's also mouthing the words of things as opposed to saying things.
Like starting to learn that maybe you don't have to just repeat everything.
He's like, when Jenny says, I love you, he's like,
Also,
for those who didn't know, I whispered, I mouthed, I love you.
I also laughed at the gym that they bought for Sunny Jim. Oh, it's now the literal Sunny Jim.
It's Las Vegas style. Yeah.
Yeah, the craziest.
Which spotlight.
I want that spotlight.
The spotlight is something Lynch uses a lot.
Yes.
Places where you're like, why is there a fucking spotlight here?
It's magical.
Like when Bob encountered Maddie, I believe, was the sequence in the second season where they used a spotlight, like totally anachronistic. In that sequence, and it happened several times throughout the length of the original show.
It harkens back to like you're doing stage productions, and that light just beams on it, so and almost like a headlight too.
And let's not forget, Sonny Jim jumping around on this gym follows the exact same pattern over and over again when he does it. He keeps repeats his pattern, and you're like, huh?
Okay,
that is telling right there.
Okay,
and let's just say real quick, like as we mentioned before with the time looping thing. The fact that this was, like, they're all like, oh, when he comes back, like, oh, he's been missing for 2 days. So when was that Dougie throwing the ball to his son thing, if not out of order?
Hmm.
And there's a lot of moments in this episode that suggest that, to put an exclamation point, that is indeed what's going on
there. Do you think it might just be to, like, it's like a postcard of the Norman Rockwell moment that he's becoming kind of attached, like Sonny Jim's becoming attached to his... kind of dopey dad, because it was right after he mentions like the father. I know Ben Horn mentions that he had a father, mm-hmm. bottom bike, and how important that
just
was.
Just to illustrate that.
Yeah. And Sonny Jim has a dad, even though he's kind of spaced out, but he's still there.
No, there's a lot of theories that when the fusion happens again, that Janie and Sonny Jim will cease to exist. That they are also just like creations of the Lodge.
That.
So I hope not. But I hope not either.
But at the same time, seem kind of like a perfect wife. I mean, she's sassy still, but that's what makes it hotter. It's like a cute son.
But if he turns back to Dale Cooper, is he going to want to like be with this married to this woman that he probably won't even remember anything about their life together? I mean, that's an awkward scenario to be sure. But he will have a really cool jungle gym. So
you win some, you lose some.
And can you see Cooper living in Vegas, really? I don't think so.
No, not really.
No.
The Fusco brothers, who are like the worst cops in the world, getting Dougie's Prince back and going, well, that's obviously nonsense.
God.
Which was like we've been waiting for these prints to come back for like 5 episodes, and they do, and they're like, well, obviously this is wrong and crumpled up and thrown away.
Like, I want to laugh because it's so perfect, but at the same time, I was so frustrated by this.
Yeah.
It's like, you've got to be shitting me. Come on.
Yeah, you're like, you expect it to be a big moment, and you're like, oh my God.
Yeah. Yeah,
like, they're the same prints from this guy, the Mr. C guy, and from this missing FBI agent. This is obviously the most important. And no, they're like, well, something must have fucked up. We're not going to bother to tell anyone.
It's like the three of them act kind of like dumber and dumbest. They're very Keystone Cops. Like, yeah. Like three cops and they can't, or three detectives and they can't figure this out. This is horrific.
And I loved yelling in the hallway.
What was going on?
It was so weird. What was happening?
Clearly David Lynch wrote all of that because it was so like, just
that
his
was
like,
great.
What's going on out there? No, don't throw that in their face. It was just screaming and yelling. Yeah, it made no sense. Like, and the guy just comes in and that guy's laugh, the one guy's laugh is the best thing in the world.
Yeah.
I love that.
That's crazy.
That is such a off-putting scenario where you're just really mad, but at the same time you're like, what is happening back there? We finally get more Mr. C, and this is definitely one of the best Mr. C episodes we've gotten
yet. Yes.
I mean, just him showing up with like Terminator 2 mode, basically, like take no prisoners, showing up instead of asking for Sarah O'Connor, he asks for Ray. And Ray is under the protection of a gang lord named Renzo.
With the smallest head imaginable. Ooh.
By the way, the official Twin Peaks Twitter, 2.5 years ago, tweeted Renzo with a question mark.
Who did that?
The official Twin Peaks fan site, like the official one, recognized one, 2.5 years ago, posted
that. So they
must
have got a tip.
or stumbled across a screenplay or something. I don't know. Very strange. But that was all they posted, and there was no explanation. But we also see with this gang, Richard Horne is there as well, who doesn't get anything to do, and they have the biggest security monitor anyone has ever seen.
That's pretty sweet.
See, now this is the place that Cooper and Ray have been talking about going to for pretty much the whole season. We're going to get to the farm.
Uh-huh.
Now, if Richard Horn's over there, that would maybe stand to reason that maybe he knows this from like through Red. So again, it kind of goes back to my theory that like Mr. C, this is all one giant criminal empire.
Yeah.
That spans the entire country. You know that Mr. C's essentially heading up or has a
but they don't know who he is, really, it seems like.
Which is weird, because if they both were going to go there, you know, I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, and he could lead it. He just doesn't, as he says, like, I don't want to lead it. I have no interest in that. And, you know, of course, Renzo making the fatal mistake where he probably could have stayed alive if he hadn't taken a cheap shot at Mr. C. And then it was like, oh, man, you fucked up.
Now. It's kind of like they didn't know. They underestimated Mr. C, like they did in Arya Stark in Game of Thrones.
Indeed, they did.
I was like, ooh, two underestimations. Look what happened.
And
it's not good.
Not that we're doing a Game of Thrones podcast, but by the way, that was an awesome episode. Arya was badass.
I also feel like Mr. C was, and this is just my interpretation, somehow less evil this episode. He didn't seem as bad.
Well, maybe that has to do with them pulling a bit of Bob out of him, as it
were. What I'm saying. Like, he's at this point. Because you think about it, he don't want me to go to the Black Lodge, but I'm not going back. But now he wants the coordinates, which we know goes to Twin Peaks, which we know goes to the Black Lodge. So really, I think he just wants to go home.
Do you think he wants to meet and have a, like, the theory, the dweller on the threshold, the shadow side of Coop, which is Mr. C, and the good side, Dougie Coop, they meet. Maybe there's a want or integration, like the good in Mr. C is wanting to meld back.
And maybe maybe he's not even aware of it, that it's happening.
Yeah, or final battle, like which one wins.
But if he did want to go back to the Black Lodge, why didn't he just put the green ring on his finger right then and there?
Well, I think it has less to do with going specifically to the Black Lodge and going more to where those coordinates are,
right.
Which is where that symbol that we keep seeing over and over again, which is the thing he said, that this is what I want. Yeah. So maybe it's some sort of personification of the power in the Black Lodge without actually having to go into the Black Lodge and trap again.
And as well as thinking something has changed inside him with one of the, like, why did they want you to kill me? They said, Ray says, talking about Philip Jeffries, who ordered the hit, he said you got something inside they want. Well, clearly they got it. we saw them get it. And, you know, everyone's like, well, Ray, you fucked up. You didn't put the ring on him. He's like, well, a bunch of woodsmen showed up, and he was like, I'm getting the fuck out of here. There's no time for ring putting on. And so, that happened.
Do you think that the Blue Rose case, that they come in when things are X-File department, but they're trying to find the Bob energy or any kind of entities that are Black Lodge, because not necessarily to kill it, but to harness a demonic entity energy for power to use for weird government.
Well, that's what Project Blue Book was trying to do when Wyndham Earle was on it back in the day.
Yeah, it's like take it and use it for a devious purpose. It's kind of like the whole atomic bomb. You want to create this power, harness it so you can scare the crap out of everyone else.
And Albert insinuates the whole reason that the project was shut down in the first book, Blue Book, was because it was a cover-up. You know, there's a very small group of people now in charge of making sure there aren't a bunch of loose threads other people can see, which is with the Blue Rose Project, you know, dealing with, like, whatever else. And even they don't, I get the feeling, I have no idea what the bigger picture is. Are, you know, they're almost a janitorial crew for this stuff.
Except the deep state comes in. CIA, Black Ops. Oh, gosh.
It's funny to me, though, that the entire internet of Twin Peaks sites, all they could focus on this episode was the Nebushi accountant who came out and said, you need some money?
It's almost like he appeared out of nowhere. He reminded me of the waiter at the Northern.
Yeah.
Just these helpful people that appear literally. Because did he just appear?
He was out the whole time, but the number of people behind him kept growing in absurd number every time the cuts out.
Like
5 people, 10 people, 20
people.
Like, what the hell's going on here?
This is a pretty big organization, all things considered.
It really is.
A bunch of dudes in the woods.
I would hope so when your security monitor's that big. I think you guys have good going on.
But we didn't talk about the over-the-top coup moment. It was pretty much the best thing ever. I mean, what did he keep saying? Return to your starting position? Return to the starting position?
Oh, yeah. It's more comfortable.
Yeah.
It's more comfortable. And I don't like my arm is bent back, which I thought was fun. Arm is bending back.
Yeah.
Definitely.
Good point. Tie back to the previous end. Often mentioned, and their arms bent back. Don't know if that was connected or not, but it was a very entertaining scene watching him just fuck with this guy.
Punch him.
Yeah. And you know this guy has never had a chance. Never even had a chance. Because Mr. C is a super villain. we see the pretty dry, but at least we get to see Big Ed finally. Norma's talking to her business partner and lover about franchising. I thought that scene was going to go somewhere else completely different because at first it's her and Ed having, you know, sitting down eating. I was like, oh, it's Ed and they're eating together. They're like together. And then Bobby shows up like, no, Bobby, you're like family. Come on, sit down and eat with us.
Yeah, it was
and
very sweet.
Yeah, and then it all turns into this thing with at least the worst taste in your mouth.
Pie recipes.
About pie recipes. The guy
showing to make them watered down and crappier instead of organic pies.
Yeah, guy's showing her pie charts about pies.
Who the fuck is Walter? It's like I immediately was like, fuck you, Walter. Who are you? You're not supposed to be here. Get out.
Well, his whole point was that when they had the car, when Richard ran over the kid, and you're like, they ran into the Double R Diner. I'm like, how could they? Wait a minute, I'm confused. Because it was the franchise. Because it was Norma's Double R Diner. It wasn't the Double R Diner. It was one of the franchise locations.
So close to by,
which
maybe
suddenly starts to answer that question. Okay, wait a minute. How could those have been the same place? Because they weren't.
They weren't.
Yeah,
and they wind back. I'm like, oh, it really isn't. It's shaped a little bit differently, and it has Norma's RR Diner on there. So
they really are different places, and not just a dream or a time travel or something.
Miriam was in the diner having pie with Norma and Shelley, and then they kind of show her coming out, and she has pie to go, and then she sees Richard run him over. Is that?
Yeah.
In little bits and pieces. Wow. Maybe they're just cheap. Miriam goes to all the places to get pies. And
she's a pie tester.
Do you realize at some point we're going to have to watch this whole thing over again because someone is going to do a fan edit of this and put it all in order of the way it's supposed to happen? Someone's going to do it at some point.
Yeah.
You know it. And then I'll watch it for sure.
Yeah, I definitely have to again, watch it.
We mentioned Nadine getting visited by Dr. Jacoby with, I guess, is supposed to be a meet cute sort of.
Well, and then that makes me wonder if Dr. Jacoby is going to play more, and I guess by proxy Nadine are going to have more of a role in wherever this ends up going than I initially thought, you know?
Very true. And yeah, at first it was felt like, well, she was in the series and she was going to be here. So we filmed something with her.
Yeah.
But maybe it's what is it? Silent Drapes?
Run Silent, run Drape.
Maybe it's more profound than we think because drapes, curtains,
Scott disagrees.
Black gloves. I don't know. Cause I'm wondering, she's such a weird person.
But that was her thing
she's
on the
so
show.
Quirky.
Her whole obsession, the original show was about opening up a silent, when she invented silent drapes. Like, oh my God, this is going to be amazing.
But
and she
who
was so
else?
Excited.
Wait, Mr.
Who,
C is super strong. She was super strong.
Yeah, but she's obsessed with the same thing David Lynch is. He's obsessed with drapes/curtains, red curtains, blue curtains.
It might just be another element of the fact that David Lynch is obsessed with drapes, you know?
Yeah.
Let's do some more drape stuff. I don't know. You
drapes
could be right.
Patches on hot women. I don't know. But I do think that her and Jacoby, that should happen, and Ed should finally just get this over with and run off with Norma.
And anything that makes like it stop being where it's just every time you see Jacoby, it's just the same fucking rain again. I'm like, you know, it's fine. Put him in the thing, but have him like off doing something with her instead of Nadine.
But it did seem it was exciting. He saw her 7 years ago and she was bent over in all fours chasing a potato.
Yes.
It seemed like he thought that was pretty hot.
That was, I mean, it could be if he didn't already know that that person was deeply unbalanced.
Yeah.
But I think it's,
there's
some connection there.
All right, so the Sarah in this sequence is frustrating because it's one of those things like the sweeping scene. It goes on for a long time and very little is happening. But the point is to emphasize there's some kind of loop. There's something wrong with time here because she's watching this boxing match, Battle in Bud, perhaps.
That is
looping. It's showing the same thing, but she's not stuck in a loop. She's doing different things. And then that we hear that electrical crackle and some sort of weird noise that keeps happening every section of sections. There's no explanation of what the fuck that is, but it's something. Clearly shit is going down in the Palmer household. We just don't have the faintest clue what it is. But yeah, it sounds like a glitch, you know, like something skipping.
And then it starts again. Yeah. Battling Bud. Wasn't that the character based on someone that David Lynch knew, an old friend, Bud or something?
Was it?
And that he based the character to like homage to his friend that died.
It may have. I didn't know if that was true. I wouldn't be surprised. It sounds like something David would do.
But again, it goes back to that thing where, you know, we're seeing Sarah Palmer stuck in this loop, the same thing over and over again. We've seen Dr. Amp stuck in the same loop, you know, all these things, even within this episode, like the whole moment between Shelley and Amanda Seyfried, Becky.
Oh, yeah.
Like, that seems like a conversation we've seen them have a couple times before. Yeah.
At that point, he's already gone.
You know?
She already shot at him. That's not a person who just shot at him.
Yeah.
Also, Shelley didn't have the wound on her face. And she wasn't hurt. So.
True.
The last 2.5 episodes seem to be about emphasizing this is all out of order. Things are happening in loops. Things are not happening in a linear sense at all in the, quote, real world. Mm. And maybe that's happening more so now because things are heightening in the terms of the connection points.
Because didn't they say it was 2 days away from this portal to open? But it's like, this is a long
And we've had like
days.
Three or four night sequences. Yeah. And then like it seemed like several days that we've watched several days begin and end in the Twin Peaks scenes in the episode since then.
It is.
Yeah.
Yeah. That seems to be the stuff to
intense.
As the episodes are going on, that's what we should be looking at and focusing on. I think the clues are there with those things, with the, wait a minute, why isn't that like that when it should be by now?
It's probably already over. We still don't even realize
it. Oh, God, no. Please, no. Also, let me point out that Lynch did say recently, like for the first time, did not say, this is it. Said, well, we'll see how it goes when asked if there would be another season. Let's see how this season does.
Hmm. Yes, the man who had an episode where someone sweeps for 7 minutes is going to take that at face value. Noob.
Well, you know, once again, though, it's like, who knows? I mean, like, he also has said recently, I can't get films made anymore. Like, nobody will finance what I want to do.
Oh.
And because that type of film is done. But obviously, television, it's not.
The Twin Peaks fans would...
Yeah.
We'll be the secret billionaires with the box.
I think it may be a while before we hear an announcement because Showtime wants to see how home release and digital stuff goes with this. Because I know it hasn't been like blockbuster Game of Thrones level things, but it also is the most amount of new subscribers at once Showtime has ever had.
That's awesome.
You know, so they may very well go, this was well worth our...
Hulu just to check it out. People are streaming like crazy. It's like one of the most streamed series ever. So.
I think a lot of it has to depend with like seeing how people react to how this all wrapping up.
Yeah.
You know, if it gets to the end and people are generally okay and it seems like, you know, in like the days and weeks after the show wrapping up, there's still more and more people kind of subscribing and starting to binge watch it and buying the books and stuff like that.
Yeah.
Then maybe they might be like, okay, let's talk about, I don't know if that'll happen just because of how much money Showtime has put down.
They've
on this
put
thing.
A lot of money on this thing.
But who knows?
I mean, it's going to depend overall how people at the end go tell their friends, definitely go seek this out and watch it. I know a lot of people are still watching the first two seasons and Firewalk with me so they can watch this.
Yeah.
We're like doing marathons.
They're not doing a very good job of watching it, though.
I know.
I mean, come on. I've had, like, what, 3 months at this point?
I know. I would have gone through it in, like,
three
week.
Times.
But there's a lot of people that I've talked to who at this point are waiting for the whole thing to wrap up.
Yeah. So they can
so then they can just kind of watch it in one fell swoop.
Which is a shame because, as we said before, I think this is one of those shows. There's a lot of shows I think are definitely better to marathon or so much more fun to marathon. Twin Peaks is not one of them. You know, if he wanted to do that, he could have done that.
Yeah.
And he chose to do it this way.
I'm glad he's doing it. It's like Christmas longer. Stretched out. I couldn't be like wait. Everyone else is getting their gifts, and you wait 3-4 months. Fuck that.
And I'm trying to rewatch them, and I'm like, oh, I'll sit and watch like six of them. After two, I'm like, I can't do this. I have to stop now because I get so tired.
Exhausting. Because it's definitely, it's not just entertainment. It's definitely, it's art.
Sure.
And so that's why it's not going to be like Game of Thrones level. It's there's a lot of heavy, weird stuff in here. And there's triggering stuff,
and
too.
It's a watercolor show, or a water cooler show. It's a show that's made for discussing with people episode by episode and putting your theories in and trying to figure out.
Well, and also kind of what you were saying about, you know, Lynch struggling to get movies off the ground now. I think that, you know, some of the, for lack of a better word, the fat on this season, you know, can kind of be explained by that. You know, some of the self-indulgences of spending an entire episode doing a black and white sequence, you know. Whereas,
oh my God, that was so good.
Which was great, but whereas normally he might not have spent a whole episode doing that, now because he hasn't made a movie in 10 years and isn't sure if he's going to be able to make another
that
one after
sense.
This, he's kind of being like, all right, like, I'm going to make this a Twin Peaks thing, but I'm going to basically make this like the all-in. This is the capstone for my entire career. So everything I've ever wanted to do, I'm just going to throw it into this,
well,
basically.
It seems like all his art, it just, between him and Mark Frost, it's weird that it's like their whole entire life work is intertwined and in itself a time loop.
Mm.
So it's and also the scene where the French girl's getting dressed really slowly, it could be clues, like Lil. And I'm also thinking, too, that David Lynch loves slow film. He likes to take time. It's very meditative. And it's a lost form. Mm. And now everything's fast cuts. We got Atomic Blonde. She's hot, but everything's moving quick. You can't focus on her. But the old films, they'll show a lady putting stockings on, or those old Betty Page ones where she's just putting the hose on and shoe flies up. And I was like, oh, that reminds me of Betty Page. And it's so hot. It's like it's a lost fetish or art form or just even just simply like seems antiquated and just romantic now.
I feel like
it's not a Tinder world back then.
He loves that style of filmmaking and realizes the best way to get people to watch it is make them feel they need to stare at it intensely or they might miss something.
Yeah. It's like, because I could watch some, like, a person smoking a cigarette or putting lipstick on for hours. To me, it's very meditative and seductive. It's beautiful filmmaking.
So, talking about the end, which I still think the end of this whole show, the camera's going to pull out of Twin Peaks and it's going to pull into the sky and it'll pull into space and it'll pull past all these planets and pull past all these galaxies. Mm. And then as it pulls back, you realize you're looking at a snow globe and there's a little kid on a hospital bed
in the hospital.
I swear to God, I will set myself on fire if that happens.
I'm kind of concerned if the end is very controversial, like Lost or that, like he might set himself on fire. There'll be people chaining themselves to a bank as someone blows it up. It's like, I could see some people losing their shit over this.
I just think it's been such a fun ride. Whatever he does, it's fine, you know?
There is a part of me that is starting to get a little concerned. I mean, most of those concerns were alleviated by this episode.
Yeah.
Because, like, having stuff like Cooper now, Evil Cooper getting the coordinates and all that, it's like, okay, we're building momentum to the end game, but there's still a part of me that is a little like, how are you going to wrap all this shit up in five episodes?
You're not wrong.
Maybe the
end of this episode, of course, we see for Renee, who I didn't recognize immediately. She was all the way. We haven't seen her since episode two when she was sitting with Shelley in a booth making eyes at James across the bar. But now we see James, the second musical act.
Oh my God.
I want to call it that. Being introduced on stage. I saw the thing made me laugh out loud when I saw it on a Twin Peaks group with somewhere. What's new, James? I have a band whose lineup mirrors my teenage love triangle, which ended after one of them was murdered. Cool.
Oh my God.
And that was just, it's just so awkward watching this sequence. I was like,
Don't you feel like it was David Lynch kind of got wind at maybe at a festival or something that people are like, we don't like James. And maybe the actor said, you know, some people don't like my character. And David Lynch is like, why? I wrote that song. I love it. And he's kind of like, fuck you. I'm going to put it in there and make you watch it again.
These are the same people who wrote the line of dialogue. James has always been cool. Yeah. So, yeah.
And I was like, oh, here we go. He is David Lynch. It's like, I wrote this song. I like it. I like this character. And you're gonna like him, too.
An interesting note, though, as Renee's watching all this, both the booth that she's in and just kind of the positioning of the shot is very similar to in season two when Maddie gets killed. And we're kind of cutting back to the roadhouse, and it's James and Donna sitting, you know, listening to Julie Cruz play, and she starts crying and all that. It's very similar kind of framing to that
shot. She's crying in the shot as well.
Yeah, you know?
For those who weren't clear enough, this song was in season two that James recorded it with Maddie and Donna.
In the world's worst, awkward, most awful scene.
Yeah, it was not a good scene.
No. It seems to me, I thought it was a hearken to the 50s and 60s with the teeny bopper crew, you can't listen to Elvis, but you can listen, what was that one Christian singer, Pat Boone. It's like safe, you know, it kind of harkened to that, this lovesick teenage stuff, and I was like, oh my God, people, you know, aren't going to understand it, it's just so out of date in our, for youth nowadays, but it's definitely something that was a big 50s thing, and so like the James Dean character, James Hurley, David Lynch is in that time capsule. He's forever. I see in his mind, he's forever a teenager, and he sees himself kind of like that. Is that he's the crooner, or maybe have dreamt of doing that one time.
Well, the actor who plays James actually friended me back on Facebook.
And he's very sweet.
I tried to get a conversation started, but he's never responded. But he posts nothing but pictures of him with other Twin Peaks stars at events, like smiling and like with their arms around each other.
Did you see that one that they did for... it was an interview, I think it was for Entertainment Weekly, and you know, the press was taking these shots, professional shots this way, and then there were some selfies, but he was sneaking up behind Kyle and Naomi Watts and taking these really bizarre angled shots, like almost looking, not upskirt, but like looking up at a low angle, and then people giggling, and behind their ear, like he's sneaking up, and these really bizarre selfies like they were teenagers.
Yeah.
They're so candid.
Yeah.
And so awesome. And I was like, and everyone's cheering on, now take a picture of this. And you'd say, can you take a picture of this? And he would do it.
Yeah.
And so it was happening in real time. Like, oh, go give Naomi a kiss. And then he'd take a picture of that. And I was like, this is fun. It's like being there.
I mean, I want to see more of James at some point, and I'm glad that we've, you know, it's been like 10 weeks but we saw him again. I just prefer it to be not in this, in his own weird time loop of
that's what I'm saying. It feels
again.
Like more a yet another reminder of maybe everyone in Twin Peaks is stuck in some weird sort of time loop, or at the very least
trauma.
A sort of consciousness, like I can't get out of this
of what happened before.
I think it's like this anti-nostalgia trip too. It's kind of like there's so much people who rail against the show are like, it's not the Twin Peaks I loved back then with Cooper and the Pie and all that stuff. Oh my God, I want that. This isn't good. Once I have that.
Yeah.
Well, it's too bad because it's what he's doing. And it's kind of like this, you get stuck in these, you get stuck in these nostalgia loops where you're like, I can only think past when I was 16 years old.
Right.
And you're not getting past that. You're stuck there.
And I think all of this, you know, in some weird way, hopefully, I could be wrong, but in theory, you know, this is all going back to the whole Laura being the one and that being the key to ending all of this somehow, you know.
Right. How everyone in Twin Peaks in their way is cursed.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, it would be tremendous trauma. Like Sarah Palmer, that doesn't seem so detached from reality. Like parents who've lost a kid, they usually divorce or someone dies off. And in this case, he died. But she becomes an alcoholic and just goes down in this dark spiral. It just doesn't seem like there's much hope. And she's in the same house to remind her.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's
those
not
Sarah
good.
Things are always so dark. I'm just like, oh man, lady, come on, actress. AA, yeah. Please. Anybody have anything else they want to bring up before we finish up? We got
no.
Got what we got.
Got what we got.
All we can do is wait for the next episode and hope that it gives us more in a satisfying way.
Please.
I just want to see. I know. I'm also like whatever. I enjoy the Dougie sequences, but that doesn't mean I'm not looking forward to him and Mr. C mashing up into Agent Dale Cooper. Am I disappointed that Dale Cooper is not the primary protagonist here of the show? I mean, in a way, but that's also just my nostalgia speaking. What I watched the show for was not for Agent Dale Cooper. I watched it for David Lynch, and that's damn sure what we got.
Yeah.
It was a pure David Lynch show and pure David Lynch enjoyment. Yes. Anyway, we'll be back in another 2 weeks with episodes 14 and 15. Ooh, getting near the end.
No.
Maybe we'll do, I feeling we'll do 16 and 17 and then just leave 18 to its own episode.
Yeah.
Where we'll kind of like look back at the whole show. Maybe even bring in some other guests. Who knows?
Yeah. Bring in a support
interesting
group.
David Lynn, Sean Mike.
What the hell happened?
I don't
know. What the hell?
It's like, I don't remember any of that.
I just dreamt this. You're all in my dream.
I got idea, man. You take me for a walk under the sycamore tree. The dark.